This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Saras Ramanathan. I'm one of the comprehensive ophthalmologists here. I'm an associate professor at UCSF. And it is my great pleasure to talk to you about the eye. It is, I am a little biased, but it is my favorite part of the human body. I think it's pretty awesome. I think you'll agree with me that the eye is often the first thing we notice when we look at someone's face, right? It's captivating. It just draws you in. I'm convinced that we even speak, we communicate with our eyes. We say things like, come a little closer, or keep your distance. I think we fall in love by looking at each other's eyes. And so you can imagine that I have passion for the eye. I feel myself very lucky to be able to talk to you about the eye. And to lead off this Osher Mini Medical School course on the eye, I've entitled my talk Light and Shadow because I think the eye is sometimes a little bit mysterious. Even other medical professionals don't often know all that much about the eye. And I'm hoping we can shed a little light, no pun intended. It is my objective that after this lecture, you will be able to identify some of the major ocular structures. I'd like you to be able to know what they do, what their functions are, and how sometimes these functions go awry and they become dysfunctional and diseased. I'd like you to be able to identify those ocular diseases and how we treat them. For those of you who like charts, I put my objectives in a chart form, and we'll refer to this throughout the lecture so that you kind of have a map of where we're going and what we've covered. We're going to go through structure, function, dysfunction, and treatment. We'll work from the front of the eye and work our way to the back. Right? So I like to start by understanding what is normal. And to do that, I often say that the eye is like a camera. Many of you may have heard that already. There are focusing elements in the front and an image capture device in the back. So in the eye, the focusing elements are here in the front, the cornea, the lens. The aperture is the pupil. The image capture device is back here, the retina, in the back of the eye. Now, from a distance, when we look at this in low magnification, there's an elegant simplicity about the eye, right? There's focusing elements, a big empty space in the middle, and then image capture device in the back. However, if we zoom in and look at it under an electron microscope, we get a sense of the amazing complexity of the ocular structures. So we're going to start. Is everyone ready? Okay. So we're going to start with the front of the eye, the ocular surface. The main function of the ocular surface, you can imagine, is to protect the structures on the inside of the eye and to lubricate. When those functions don't work properly, we end up with dry eye and blepharitis, for which we have to treat with some sort of regimen of artificial tears or lubrication and lid hygiene. Let's go back to our camera example. Remember, the eye is like a camera. Well, if that's the case, then the ocular surface is like the lens cap. Okay, it protects and lubricates. Most of the structures you kind of know. The eyelids are a main structure. This here is the eyelid in cross-section. And then the conjunctiva, which actually starts on the inside of the eyelid, works all the way up here to a pocket up at the top underneath the eyelid, and then reflects back and attaches to the edge of the cornea. Now, people often ask me if they wear contact lenses, if they can lose that contact lens in the back of the eye. Well, the answer is you can't lose anything into the back of the eye because there's that pocket of conjunctiva. You might have to fish around for it, but ultimately you can't lose anything behind the eye. Now, I want you to notice that inside the eyelids and in the conjunctiva, there are some glands, and they secrete substances that are very important. The conjunctiva has these tear glands right here, accessory tear glands. These are responsible for the basal layer of tear, the basal tear production. Not the tears that you cry, but rather the tears that are produced all the time to keep your eyes moist. The conjunctiva is also responsible for these goblet cells. They secrete mucin that help the tears adhere to the eye. The eyelids have these oil glands called meibomian glands that are responsible for secreting an oil that helps keep the tears from evaporating. Let's look at that tear layer a little bit more closely. There are three components. Again, the mucin layer that sort of makes the tears stick to the cornea. There's the actual water layer that lubricates the eye and that contains nutrients for the surface of the eye. And then there's this oily layer that keeps the tears from evaporating too quickly. So what happens if there's a problem with that tear layer and it doesn't work properly? Well, then we get a dry eye. Dry eye is caused by either too little tears, decreased production, or increased evaporation. Reasons that there should be decreased production are what we call primary disease, meaning those secretory cells in the conjunctiva aren't working properly. There may be inflammation of the ocular surface due to either infection, drugs, underlying disease processes. Sometimes the reason for the dry eye is because the eyes are just too open. There's too much evaporation, as in thyroid eye disease. Other times there is loss of that oil layer. The oil layer just isn't competent. When we see a dry eye problem, we like to treat it by either increasing the amount of tears or decreasing the evaporation. So to increase the amount of tears, our mainstay of treatment is to add artificial tears. So we often ask our patients to buy over-the-counter tears and use them several times a day. We also might ask you to take supplements like flaxseed oil or fish oil. We may prescribe cyclosporin eye drops to decrease the inflammation of ocular structures, of the ocular surface structures, and increase the tear production. Or we may also just plug the little drains that drain the tears with a plug that fits right into the tear drainage duct of the eyelid. And that way, you don't produce any more tears, but the tears that you do produce don't drain away from the eye.
How much is drained away on an average basis? Is it like a teaspoon? Is it milliliters?
How much does the eye produce and how much is drained away? Well, production depends on environment. A drier environment may require more production, but on average, the eye holds less than one drop at any given moment. And really, there isn't much drainage other than the excess. So if you put a drop of artificial tears, here's an experiment that you yourself can do, put a drop of artificial tears on your eye and just keep your eyes closed and see how long does it take for that drop to feel like it's left your eye. You'll find, I think, it takes about 10 minutes before that drop, before you feel like the eye is kind of normal again. Okay? Now, if there's too much evaporation, we like to decrease that evaporation. Often, the reason the tears evaporate too much is because the oil layer is incompetent. And so we may augment that with ointment. The ointments on the market have an oil. It can be mineral oil. It can be other oils in there. And that acts, I always call it hand lotion for the eyes. It sort of mixes with the tears and keeps those tears from evaporating. We also might try, some people like these moisture chambers. Basically, they're goggles that you wear. They have a gasket made out of foam or rubber that sort of attach the glasses to the eye, to the face, and create sort of a humid moisture chamber around the eyes and allow for decreased evaporation. My favorite thing to do is treat the underlying oil gland dysfunction. So let's talk about the oil glands. They deserve a little attention. Again, the reason for this is because this is one of the most common problems that I treat all day long. Remember, the oil glands in the eyelids are these meibomian glands. There are something like 25 of them in the upper lid and 13 or so in the lower lid. And they secrete an oil that you can actually see. If you go to your mirror and you look at your eyelid margin very closely, you'll see little droplets of oil collecting on that eyelid margin, and they should look just like that, nice and clear, watery, or thin, rather. And the purpose of those oils is to mix with the tears and create a nice, even tear layer, oil layer in the tears over the ocular surface. Now, if they aren't working properly, you are going to feel a foreign body sensation, often like sand or grit that's in the eye. You may have some burning, and you definitely may have some redness around the eyelids, the eyelid margins, or even on the conjunctiva as well. When I look in the eye, what I'm going to see is that all those little tear ducts are now clogged up with this thickened, waxy oil that doesn't make its way out of those oil glands very easily. It certainly doesn't do a very good job of mixing with the tears, and so it isn't able, that those oils are not able to prevent those tears from evaporating. Does that all make sense so far? Are you with me? All right. So if one or several of those oil glands becomes infected, focally infected, you may have this sty or hordeolum, which then becomes later, we call it a chalazion. That may require some antibiotics, or it may even require surgical drainage. There are lots of ways to treat blepharitis. I think some of them are a little scary. My favorite method is the simplest method. We know that the oils are too thick, and we know that they're kind of waxy. So what's the best way to deal with oils that are too thick and that are waxy? What do you think? Heat them. That's right. Melt that oil and get them out of those glands. I think that was the purpose of this device down here. I'm not even quite sure what that does. Anyhow, so what we want to do is heat the eyelids. Not too much. Let's not burn ourselves. But what I tell people is you have to get yourself on a regimen of warm compresses with a little baby shampoo. So how do you do that? You take a clean washcloth, dip it in hot tap water, squeeze out the water, pour a little baby shampoo on that towel, lather it up, close your eyes, hold the towel over the closed eyelids for 1 minute, then rub the lids and lashes, still with the eyes closed, for another 30 seconds. Then wash off the shampoo. Question. Twice a day, morning and bedtime.
Question.
Yes.
Why baby shampoo? Why not adult shampoo?
So the question is, why baby shampoo? Why not any other kind of shampoo? The reason is baby shampoo is pH balanced to not sting. It's the only kind of soap that really won't sting the eyes. And, you know, even though you do it with the eyes closed, some of that shampoo is probably going to get in the eyes, so we don't want you to sting, because the blepharitis is already causing some burning, most likely. I often tell people that after a month you can stop using the shampoo, but you have to keep doing the warm compresses twice a day. It's kind of like brushing your teeth. You don't just brush your teeth when you have bad breath. You do it twice a day, every day, forever. Okay. When the blepharitis is bad enough, we often have to prescribe antibiotics or even steroids to control infection and inflammation. So let's review what we talked about for ocular surface. We talked about the structures, the eyelids, the conjunctiva, and the tear gland, the glands associated with both of those structures, and the tear layer. We talked about the functions, basically protection and lubrication. When those functions become abnormal, you get a dry eye and blepharitis. The treatment is for those two is improved tear function with variety of means, or improved tear layer, and lid hygiene. The next section that we're going to talk about is focusing, the focusing elements of the eye. The main two focusing elements are the cornea and the lens. Cornea and lens. Their job is to focus light. When they don't work, we have abnormalities of focus and we have cataract, the treatment of which is some sort of spectacle correction or vision correction and surgery. The eye is like a camera. So the focusing elements in a camera are basically the lens of the camera and the aperture of the camera. In the eye, the focusing elements are the lens and the cornea. The cornea is this clear structure right in the front of the eye. The lens is this nice, clear, round lens right behind the pupil. And, of course, the pupil is the aperture. When we look at any object, we are looking at it, and the light that comes from that object has to be focused. And it has to be focused in the 1 inch or so between the front of the eye and the back of the eye. So we need a very powerful focusing system to do that. And as a result, we have two separate focusing devices, the cornea and the lens. The cornea does about 70% of that focusing. The lens does about 30% of that focusing. The pupil, just like in a camera, changes its size to let in just the right amount of light to allow for optimal focus and depth of focus, or depth of field. If you look at the cornea and the lens under a microscope, you will see that they are really quite impressive structures. Do you see how they're laid out in layers of cells? Layers of uniform cells. Why? Because they have to be transparent, right? They have to let in light. How many structures in the body do we know of that are transparent, like a window? I think it's amazing. I think it's awesome, actually. And they have to do their job without any blood vessels. Why? Because you can't have blood vessels in the middle of a transparent substance. Otherwise, it won't let light through properly, right? So we have these structures. The cell bodies are all flattened. Look over here. You can see these cell bodies. And look at how uniform those layers of cells are. They're all filled with proteins. The proteins refract the light. They bend the light just the right amount to make that light hit the back of the eye. So this, normally, a normal eye, light comes in from the object, passes through these two structures, and it gets bent. The light gets bent so that if I'm focusing on my cup, the light from my cup enters my eye and focuses within 1 inch to the back of the eye to a point. This entire cup that's, what, 6-8 inches tall has to turn into a point that's less than a millimeter tall onto the back of my eye. Now, let's say that doesn't work properly. Well, then we have errors of focus or abnormalities of focus. There are three main abnormalities of focus: nearsightedness, farsightedness, and astigmatism. Now, the other thing that we could have is simply a cornea or a lens that isn't transparent, right? That's cloudy or scarred. The most common problem in that type of situation is cataract. It's a cloudy lens. We'll talk about all of these things. Let's start with the nearsighted patient or the nearsighted person. In this situation, the cornea and the lens complex focus light excessively. They focus in front of the retina. Instead of focusing right on the back of the retina, somehow these structures focus on the front, just in front of the retina. You can think of this in two ways. You can either think that the lens and the cornea combination, the focusing elements, focus too well or too powerfully, and so they focus in front. Or you can think of it as the eye being too long, and the eye is too long for the focusing elements. Doesn't matter. The point is that there's a mismatch. The farsighted patient, conversely, has an eye that's too short or focusing elements that don't focus enough. And as a result, the image from the object is focused behind the retina. What the retina sees is a blurred image, a non-focused image. The third problem is astigmatism. So most of our corneas are shaped kind of like a basketball. But the person with astigmatism has a cornea that's shaped more like a football. So basketball, what do we notice about it? It tends to be sort of spherical in all directions, right? The same curvature in all directions. Whereas the football has a different curvature in one direction than it has in the other direction. So you can imagine if the cornea is shaped like a basketball, it's going to, light that hits it this way as well as light that hits it this way are both focused equally, correct? But the person who has the eye, the cornea that's shaped like a football, has more focusing in the more curved direction and less focusing in the less curved direction. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So as a result, we have, instead of one point of focus on the retina, we have 2 points of focus on the retina. And you can imagine that if there is a very uneven or unusual surface to the cornea that isn't as just different in two directions, then we can have a lot of distortion. As in this patient, there are multiple different planes, and instead of all focusing in one point, they focus in at different points. As a result, you get distortion. And the way I explain it to people so that you can sort of have an idea of what that feels like is it's kind of like looking at those circus mirrors. You know, it's you look in there and you see something, but it's distorted because those mirrors, remember, have different focal points all throughout that mirror. So it's very similar to what's happening in astigmatism. So how do we fix all these errors of astigmatism? Well, we work a lot with some kind of spectacle or contact lens. We do surgery on the cornea and on the lens to correct these problems. So how do glasses work? I think glasses are an amazing discovery. What did we do before glasses, right? We all went around kind of defocused, I guess. The nearsighted person who's focusing, remember their focusing elements focus too hard and they're focusing in front of their eye. What do we do for them? We put a lens in front of their eye that actually defocuses the light just a little bit so that their eyes that are focusing too much, they still do what the eye will continue to do what it knows how to do. It'll focus too much. But since now we've compensated with this defocusing lens, the image now focuses precisely on the back of the eye, on the retina. On the opposite problem is the farsighted patient whose cornea lens complex doesn't focus well enough. So for that person, we put more plus power lens. We put additional focusing help in front of the eye, and that allows this plus the patient's cornea lens complex to work together to focus on the back of the eye. All right, so now what do we do for the astigmat? How does that work, right? Well, now we have to have a lens that's shaped kind of like a cylinder. It is more curved in one direction than it is in the opposite direction. And we put that lens in front of the patient with astigmatism. And as a result, and we counterbalance the axes that the patient has with our cylinder axis. Does that make sense? So we line up the patient's steep axis with the flat axis of the cylinder. We line up the flat axis of the patient with the steep axis of the cylinder. Does that make sense? Okay. Well, that works really well when the patient has only two axes that are opposite. Unfortunately, that's most of the people out there. We use contact lenses much the same way, except the contact lens is on the surface of the eye. The person who benefits the most from contact lenses is the astigmat, the person with astigmatism. Look at this cornea. It's super irregular, right? It has, you know, it has more than one axis of irregular curvature. Now we put a perfectly spherical contact lens on top of that patient's cornea, and we allow the tear layer in green to fill in the gap between their eye and the contact lens. So in fact, what we've done is we've taken the patient's football-shaped eye, we've put a spherical basketball-shaped contact lens on top, we've allowed the tear layer to make up the difference, and now this patient has really good vision. Now, what if the patient can't wear contact lenses? Then we have to do something else. Well, now we have this vision correction surgery. The whole idea behind vision correction surgery is that we're going to take this person's football or take this person's cornea that is focusing excessively, and we're going to reshape it. So the nearsighted cornea that is too spherical and is too steep and focusing too hard, we're going to flatten that cornea out. The farsighted patient whose cornea is too flat and isn't focusing well enough or focusing hard enough, we're going to make that a little steeper. The astigmat who has a football-shaped cornea, let's just turn that football into a basketball. And how do we do it? We cut a flap of cornea, very thin flap. We reflect it back. We apply laser to the bed to change the underlying shape. Then we replace that flap back and allow it to heal. And now this patient has new vision, basically, without spectacles or contact lenses. Does everyone understand that?
So the laser is actually cutting. It's your knife.
The question is the laser actually cutting? Yes, it does cut. What it actually does is it explodes that tissue so that it just sort of evaporates. It's pretty impressive, actually. But that tissue is being removed. The question is, can LASIK surgery compensate for both astigmatism and near or farsightedness? And the answer is yes, depending on how much of each of those the patient has. There are some limits as to what LASIK can do. And that's actually a great question for me to go into this next category, which is phakic lens implants. Phakic means someone who has their natural lens. Phakus means lens. And so this is a person who has their natural lens and their cornea, but maybe their cornea is too thin and we can't reshape it. So that's a person we might want to put a contact. It's kind of like putting a contact lens inside the eye. We put an additional lens inside the eye to correct either nearsightedness or farsightedness. We can put it behind the pupil or in front of the pupil. The other thing we can do is we can actually remove the patient's natural lens and put in an artificial lens. That we do that often when the patient is so nearsighted that they aren't amenable to other treatments. We don't like to do it that often, I'll be honest with you. It's not something we do a lot of, but it is available. So what about that lens? We've been talking a lot about the cornea and reshaping the cornea, but what about the lens? The lens is very important because it is the source of one of the biggest problems, the number one cause of vision loss worldwide, which is cataract. Well, again, the lens is made up of layers, just like I showed you before, layers of sort of perfectly, sort of like an onion, perfectly layered cells. And the purpose of those layers of cells is to bend light. The cornea is beautifully clear. If you look at a cornea of a 15-year-old, it will look like a window pane, beautifully clear. It provides differential focus. That's one thing that the lens. I'm so sorry. The lens is beautifully clear, and the one thing it doesn't do, the one thing that the cornea can't do that the lens can do is it can provide differential focus, right? The cornea has one power, and it just focuses that much all the time. The lens can change shape and focus differently at distance. It can focus on distant objects, and it can focus on near objects. And the way it does that is by changing its shape. It gets more round and ball-like when we're looking at things close up and flatter when we're looking at the distance. Now, as we get older, that ability starts to deteriorate, and that's why we all have, me included, we have our reading glasses that we need now to focus up close. As we all get older, the other thing that happens is we all develop cataract. Cataract is a natural, gradual opacification of that lens of the eye. It is usually due to, always aging and UV light play a role. It can also be due to underlying disease such as diabetes. It can be due to drugs such as steroids. And it can also be due to genetics. We see cataracts in all age groups, but we certainly see most of them in our senior population. I love this quote by Andy Rooney. He says, everyone likes the idea of living a long life, but no one really wants to get old. I agree. This is a typical cataract. You can see it from, I always say you can see a dense cataract from the door, right? It is the number one cause of decreased vision worldwide. But in this country, fortunately, we do a pretty good job of taking out cataracts. There are many types of cataracts, a white cataract, a what we call posterior subcapsular cataract, cataracts related to trauma, medications, but they all do kind of the same thing. They blur your vision. They give you glare, dull or dim vision. You know, before I became an ophthalmologist, I never really used that word dim, but my patients use that word maybe more than any other word to describe what it feels like to have a cataract. Their vision gets dim. Also, they notice that they're all of a sudden, they hadn't been getting new glasses for years, but now all of a sudden they need a new pair of glasses every year. Why? Because those proteins in the lens have started to oxidize, and that changes the refractive error, the refractive index, and so your prescription changes. Often the light conditions that work well change also. Most people report that they need more light. There are a couple kinds of cataracts that actually do worse in bright light, but for the most part, people need more light. Now, we try to treat cataracts for as long as possible with glasses. As long as you are seeing well in new glasses, we like to mitigate the risk and put you in new glasses. However, at some point, that just doesn't work anymore. And then, if you feel impaired and you are no longer able to do the things in your daily life, activities of daily living, that you want to do and need to do, that's when we take the cataracts out. We always weigh the risk and the benefit. We always wait until the benefits outweigh the risk. There are many kinds of cataract surgery. I'm going to tell you, you'll have a whole talk by my dear friend Cynthia Chu, who gives a wonderful cataract talk. Don't miss that one because it's super good. She'll tell you all about the different ways to take out cataracts, and she'll give you a lot more information about cataract. But I tell my patients that cataracts are like, taking out cataracts are like dealing with a peanut M&M. A cataract has a capsule that's like the hard candy coating of an M&M, and it has a hard nut in the center, which we want to get out. And that nut is covered with a soft chocolate coating. All right, for those of you who are squeamish, you got to close your eyes. I'm going to show you cataract surgery. Close your eyes if you can't handle it. All right, so here we are. We're making an opening in that hard candy coating. Now, that hard candy coating is 9 microns thick. That's really thin, all right? It's like a film. But we have to keep it intact. Why? Because it is going to hold our lens implant. I've stained it blue, and now we've made a perfectly round opening in that hard candy coating. And now look at that nut. There's mostly nut. There's not much chocolate in that cataract. So we are going to use our probe that delivers ultrasound energy to that cataract. We're going to break it up into small pieces. You'll see us breaking it right there. That will allow us to take little pieces out bit by bit by bit. And we make our way. You can imagine that those pieces are relatively sharp, and we have to do this really carefully. I have a lot of patients who feel that cataract is kind of a walk in the park. And believe me, it's not my first walk in the park as far as cataract surgery goes, but I always have great respect for the surgery and for what we're doing, because we're operating in a tiny space and all kinds of things can go wrong. But in general, we have excellent results, and we're able to take that cataract out and leave that hard. Remember our hard candy coating? We're going to leave that in place so that we can put a lens implant in. Now, this lens implant we fold it up into a ball, or sort of a ball, a taco, really, and we inject that lens implant into the eye. It's made out of acrylic. You don't see it or feel it. Sometimes you see a little reflection off of it if you're looking at it. And that goes right into that capsule, and we center it. And it stays in there. You can see it has two little feet on either end, and those feet open up, and they allow that lens to stay centered in the eye. It's nice and clear, just like the lens of that 15-year-old, and we leave it there.
And is the patient awake?
Yes, the patient is awake and talking to me, moving his eye around.
Okay.
Absolutely.
How long did that take?
Well, that surgery probably took us maybe 40 minutes. This was a very dense cataract. I show you a very dense cataract because otherwise it's really hard to see all the steps and all the removal. A typical cataract that we see here doesn't take that long. I hate to tell you how long it takes because then it almost feels like it trivializes the surgery, and it's not trivial to me at all. However, we do a pretty good job. Yeah.
Separate structure, or is it just a lens that's gone bad?
That's a great question. The question is the cataract different from, is it its own separate thing, or is it a lens that's just gone bad? Really, it is the lens that has become opacified. That is a cataract. The entire lens is opacified. We take the entire lens out.
Cataract is a bad lens.
Cataract equals bad, cloudy lens. People always ask me, they feel like the cataract is a film that you remove from the lens. It's not a film. A cataract is the substance of the lens becoming cloudy and opacified. You can't take the cataract out and leave any part of the lens back. It doesn't work. Yes, sir. The question is there a diet association? Can you eat something special or not eat something special that will slow down cataract surgery? Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be. We've done a fair number of studies with supplements and vitamins, and all we know, and none of it seems to slow down cataract.
So a vegetarian would be just as likely to develop this as someone who eats steak five times.
I love these questions. Yes, a vegetarian will have will have the same likelihood to have a cataract as a steak eater.
Okay.
I'm going to keep going, if I may, just for time. Let me keep going. I love these questions. Please write them down or something, and I'll answer every single one, I promise. So cataract is an opacification of the lens. The vision decline usually comes with impairment of activities of daily living. We change glasses until that doesn't work anymore, and then it's time to do cataract surgery as long as the risks are outweighed by the benefit. Okay, so remember what we've talked about. We've talked about abnormalities of focus, right? These are focusing elements. So we talked about refractive error, nearsightedness, farsightedness, astigmatism. And we talked about how we deal with those problems, namely corrective lenses, either contact lenses or spectacles. We talked about vision correction surgery and these phakic IOLs. Then for the lens component, we talked about cataract being an opacification of the natural lens, requiring new glasses to correct the new refractive error. And we talked about cataract surgery when new glasses don't help anymore. We also talked about clear lens extraction as another option for spectacle-free living.
Get rid of the cost.
Okay, so the question is, I'm going to rephrase it a little bit, how do you determine the appropriate technique for cataract surgery? There is an art to that. It depends on the density of the cataract. It depends on other structures in the eye as to what is the best technique. It also depends on how experienced the surgeon is with different types and densities of cataracts. I would say that the vast majority of surgeons use phacoemulsification. If you were to ask that question 20 years ago, it might be 50-50 because people were learning phacoemulsification in those days. But these days, just about everyone is doing phacoemulsification unless the lens is too dense for that procedure, or if there are other problems such as there are structures that are weak in the eye and need to be supported in a different way. Question.
Yes, is that?
The question is there a risk of allergy to the lens implant? We have tried many different substances for that lens implant. The two main substances these days are silicone and acrylic. Acrylic tends to be a little bit more well-tolerated than silicone, just a little bit. And there's almost no risk of allergy. However, some people don't tolerate a lens implant, not because they're allergic to it, but because their eye, it rubs on the eye, the shape of the eye doesn't quite take the lens implant well. And so the implant can be removed, but the vast majority of patients tolerate the implant without difficulty.
But if you remove it, what will happen? Will they be without a lens?
So the question is, if we remove it, what are the options then? The options are that they can have a spectacle. Those are the thick glasses. We like to stay away from that. But a good option is a contact lens. Contact lenses work well. Yes, sir?
You mentioned how the lens kind of opened up by itself after you
yes.
put it in there. Is there a springy material around the edge?
No, there's no. Well, so the question is, how does the lens implant open up once we inject it into the eye? It has a memory. That acrylic lens implant has a memory. It wants to be open. And so it opens slowly, and we, while it's opening, we position it where we want it to be, and it sort of goes back to the shape it wants to be in, if you will. Yes, sir?
Do you choose a focal length for the lens you implant?
The question is, do you choose a focal length for the lens you want to implant? We absolutely choose a focal length for the implant. We measure the size of the eye because we basically have to figure out what the natural lens of the eye was doing, how powerful it was, and we have to replicate that, or we try to do a little better. So we try to get rid of underlying nearsightedness or farsightedness. We have lenses that can correct for astigmatism or counteract the astigmatism. We even have lenses that correct for both near and far. And I'm going to defer questions more about lens implantation and maybe defer questions about cataract surgery, because you're going to have a great lecture all about cataracts, and I hate to steal my partner's thunder. Yes, sir? The question is, once you find out you have a cataract, how much time do you have before you need surgery? You know, that's a style question. Some ophthalmologists don't even mention cataract until it's time to have surgery. And some, I'm a little bit different. I will tell my patients, well, you have a cataract. We're not going to do anything about it, or we're going to prescribe new spectacles or something. But right now, they're not bothering you. We're not going to touch them. And usually, I tell everybody that most people develop cataracts somewhere in their mid-50s, okay? But they don't get the cataracts out till they're maybe late 60s, early 70s. It really depends on a variety of things. One, how fast does the cataract grow? And two, how tolerant are you of that visual disability? Some people aren't tolerant at all. Once they move off that 20/20 vision, they are not happy. There are other people, like the patient I showed you in my surgical video, she could only see light. And I had to make her have that cataract out. So everybody's different. All right, let's move on. Our next section is the aqueous humor. And I'll tell you what that is. Aqueous humor, its purpose is to nourish the structures of the front of the eye and to create eye pressure so that your eye isn't a squashed grape. The most common disease of the aqueous humor is glaucoma, which we treat with drops and surgery. So let's look at that. So here's our eye. Remember, our focusing elements, remember, they're clear, right? They have no blood vessels. So how are they going to get any nutrition, right? There's no blood vessels, but they need oxygen. They need nutrients just like any other living tissue. So the way they get nutrition is through the aqueous humor. That is a fluid that is produced by this structure, the ciliary body. The fluid bathes the lens and the anterior chamber and the cornea, bringing oxygen and various nutrients so that those tissues can do their appropriate functions. Again, it's produced here. That fluid travels around the lens through the pupil in on the inside of the cornea, and it's making its way to this drain. There's a drain right here in the angle. The cornea and the colored part of the eye, or the iris, makes an angle. Can you see that? And in that angle, circumferentially, all the way around that angle, there's a drain called the trabecular meshwork. And that drain needs to be open. It needs to be open because this fluid has to drain out through there. Now, there is a condition called open-angle glaucoma where the aqueous fluid has access to the drain. It gets to the drain, but somehow inside here, that drain is clogged. The drain is clogged. That's analogous to the sink that has a clogged drain somewhere below the sink, and the fluid can't, the sink won't drain, right? There's another, and this is open-angle glaucoma. So the angle is open, but the drain doesn't drain. The drain is clogged. There's another condition called closed-angle glaucoma. This is where the drain itself is open, but the fluid can't get to the drain. Why? Because if there is something blocking that drain. This is analogous to the sink that has the drain stopper on it, right? The drain's open under that drain stopper, but the water can't get through the drain stopper to drain. Okay, so here the iris has plugged up that drain, plugged up that angle. It can either happen here peripherally where the angle is blocked, or it can happen by scarring at the pupil, where the pupil is scarred down to the lens and that fluid can't get around that pupil to access that angle. Both of those cause a closed angle glaucoma. Glaucoma is important because it affects over 3 million Americans. 50% of the patients with glaucoma do not know that they have it. That's huge. That's a major problem. It is the number one cause of vision loss in our African American population, and it tends to be worse and occur earlier in those patients. The average cost of treatment can be up to $2,500 per patient per year, so it is a significant burden. What is glaucoma? Glaucoma, if I were to define it, is I would define it as a disease in which there is progressive damage to the optic nerve, which results in a characteristic pattern of visual field loss or side vision loss. It is usually, but not always, associated with high eye pressure. It is a silent disease. It is symptom-free until very late, and I'll show you why that is. Early peripheral visual field loss really goes unnoticed. You know, if you think about it, you're not that aware of what's happening out here unless it's big. Only at the very end do people really notice the effect of glaucoma, and as a result, it goes undiagnosed for years. Risk factors for glaucoma include age, race, family history, high eye pressure, other ocular diseases such as uveitis and dense cataract also, steroid use, and smoking. Again, we talked about two types, open angle and closed angle. In both these types, the fluid can't get out of the eye. It causes a buildup. The pressure is increased. That pressure is transmitted to the back of the eye, specifically the optic nerve, and that optic nerve then gets damaged. And it is damaged in a particular pattern. The pattern of glaucomatous visual field loss is where we start with normal vision, and you can see here in the next picture that this earliest side vision is blocked. That is not vision that anyone's going to notice. Then it starts to get a little bit more noticeable. So let's say you're driving on the street. You can see all this traffic here, right? By the time you have fairly significant vision loss, you don't see all this traffic. You're really kind of concentrated right here in the middle. And finally, all you see is the bus or whatever this structure, the truck. you miss all this other traffic. So imagine that's quite devastating. All of a sudden, there are so many things that you really can't do. When we look at patients, what are we looking for? We're looking for that characteristic loss of nerve tissue in the optic nerve. We're looking for high eye pressure that is not between 10 and 21. That's kind of normal pressure. In general, we treat people above pressures of about 25 because we know that even if we don't see vision loss where they are now, if we leave them untreated, they're likely to develop vision loss. We also look at formal visual field testing, and I'll show you how we do that. And we look at thinning of that optic nerve fiber layer. Here's how we check the pressure. How many of you have had your eye pressure checked? Awesome! So we literally touch your eye with this probe that has a little blue light on it, and the amount of pressure that it takes for you to indent the front of your eye tells us what the pressure inside of your eye is. We also look at that angle. We can put a special lens on your eye called a gonioprism, and we have a direct view of that trabecular meshwork. It's right here. And if we can't see it, then we know that it's not draining, and we have to fix that. Now, if we can see it, we know that the angle's open, but we don't know if the drain is clogged on the inside where we can't see. Does that make sense? Okay. We also look at the optic nerve. We want to know if that nerve looks suspicious so that it might be damaged. And what we're looking specifically for is the cup-to-disc ratio. The central part is the cup, and this outer part is the rim. Now, if you look at this, can I convince you that maybe the cup-to-disc ratio is about 0.4 or 40%? Maybe? I'd call that about a 0.4. Here is a normal optic nerve. Cup-to-disc ratio, I'd call this about a 0.2. 20%. Here's a glaucomatous optic nerve. I'd call this cup-to-disc ratio maybe about a 0.8, about 80%. So if I see this patient for the first time, I have a very high index of suspicion that this person has glaucoma. Glaucoma until proven otherwise. Now, we also measure the peripheral vision. Convince all of you that if you're looking straight ahead, you're aware of what's above your line of sight and below your line of sight. You're also aware of what's to the sides on both sides. With both eyes open, you have almost 180 sweep of what you're able to see side to side and not quite 180 degrees top to bottom. But you can see a lot. The glaucomatous patient has only straight-ahead vision. The side vision is significantly impaired. We want to quantify that, and we want to follow it. So we ask that person to undergo a visual field test. We put them in front of a screen. There's a screen inside here. And we make them fixate on a target. They have to look at the target. And then here they hold this little clicker in their hand, and then we shine lights on that screen. We start with big lights, big bright lights, and then we get kind of mean. We make them smaller and dimmer and smaller and dimmer until the patient can't see them anymore, and that's their threshold. And then we do it 5 more times so that we make sure we have an accurate reading. And we do that on each eye. And then the computer prints out something that looks like this. This is a visual field. This spot right here is where the optic nerve inserts into the back of the eye. It is supposed to be black. The rest of it is nice and light. Why? Because the patient sees all those spots. Patient with glaucoma starts out maybe looking kind of normal, but then look at this. Side vision starts to be impacted. And then if you wait longer, it gets worse and marches slowly centrally until finally there's only a central island of vision left. This is untreated. And here is another very specific pattern of glaucomatous vision loss. So we take these three pieces of data along with the pressure and the view of the angle, and we put it together to understand, does this person have glaucoma? And if so, how are they responding to our treatment? So So we do this these three tests serially. Oh, the one in the middle is an optical coherence tomogram. It's an optical image of the thickness of the nerve fiber layer around the rim, that optic nerve rim. We can measure it and follow it also over time. So we can see if there's thinning. I'm sorry, what was that question?
What is a tomogram?
A tomogram is the image created by light that is projected into the back of the eye and reflected back and measured. That is a tomogram. Once we decide that the person has glaucoma, we want to treat them. And we start by treating them with drops. Drops are the mainstay of glaucoma treatment. We use pressure-lowering drops. They come in many different types with different mechanisms of action. Often we use more than one drop so that they work synergistically. There are some glaucoma oral medications that we try not to use because they tend to have a lot more side effects. Our goal is always to reduce the pressure by 30 to 50%. I always go for 50%. I don't always get it. I'm happy if I get 30, but I try for 50. What our goal is the eventual goal, of course, is to stop the progression of visual field loss and to stop the progression of optic nerve damage. There was a question here.
Before you increase the eye pressure?
The question is, what do the drops do? The drops are meant to decrease the eye pressure. Yes, sir.
Is it helping the eye to drain where it could not drain?
The drops work in a variety of ways. Some of the drops encourage more drainage. Some of the drops encourage less production. So they work in both of those ways. You're going to have an extremely good lecture on glaucoma, too. I always feel bad, you know, talking about things that are coming up. Yes. The question is, in the picture of the optic nerve that I showed you with the blood vessels coming out of the optic nerve, does the position of the blood vessels either in the center of the nerve or to the sides make a difference? And the answer is really that it doesn't make a difference. The vessels are climbing up the inside of the nerve, and so if the nerve tissue is lost, the vessels are going to be pushed over to the side because they depend on those nerves to provide structure. They can't just hang out in the middle. They're attached to those nerves. One more question.
Does a patient generally develop glaucoma in both eyes, or can only one eye develop that condition?
The question is, does glaucoma tend to be unilateral or bilateral? It is usually bilateral. Occasionally we see unilateral glaucoma. It may be asymmetrically bilateral, but it is most of the time bilateral. Okay, so now what if the drops don't work? What other options do we have? We can do laser treatment, and we can do surgery. We have laser treatment for open-angle glaucoma and laser treatment for closed-angle glaucoma. Here is our laser treatment for open-angle glaucoma. What we're trying to do is deliver laser treatment to the trabecular meshwork, right to the drain. Either we're going to do a laser treatment that makes little cuts in that drain, thereby opening it up, or we are going to deliver laser treatment that makes tiny little burns to that angle, to that drain, so that it stretches, it coagulates the focal tissue and stretches the adjacent tissue. Does that make sense? So we're either going to burn a little bit or cut a little bit. Either way, the drain opens and flow increases, pressure goes down. For the angle closure patient, we need to provide access for that aqueous humor to get to that angle so that it can drain. Because remember, the drain is perfectly fine, right? It's just that it's blocked from the aqueous is blocked from getting to the drain. So in this case, we make a little hole in the peripheral iris, the colored part of the eye, so that instead of having to go around the pupil, it can go right through that hole and get to the drain where it needs to go. Does that make sense? So if you look at that patient, here's their pupil. They will have a tiny little hole in the periphery here so that that aqueous can drain through it. Question?
Yeah, with the close half or the side.
The question is, where do you put that hole? Do you put it at 12 o'clock or 3 o'clock or 6 o'clock? Where do you put it? There is a lot of controversy, a little bit of controversy, about where you put that hole. When I started ophthalmology decades ago, we were trained to put them at 12 o'clock or somewhere between 11 and 1. And now things are turning more towards putting them at 3 o'clock or 9 o'clock because that tends to interfere with the tear layer in the eyelids a little bit less. But basically, you will find that people will do both. I always look at the patient's eyelids. If I can have that hole covered by the eyelid, then I'll put it superiorly. If the eyelids won't cover the hole, I'll put it at 9 o'clock or 3 o'clock. Does that make sense? I never put it at 6 because that's never covered by your eyelids.
Well, when you say the eyelid isn't going to cover the hole, I mean, does someone see a hole there?
No, it's not so that people – it's not so that people will look at you and see the hole. It's so that the hole doesn't act as a secondary pupil. And you'd say, and then you might say to me, well, if you put it at 9 o'clock or 3 o'clock, surely it's going to be a secondary pupil. But it turns out that there's magnification from the tear layer that makes that secondary pupil more of an issue when it's superiorly than when it's at 9 or 3. That's a lot more information than you really wanted to know. All right. So... now, let's talk just a little bit about surgical treatment. Again, you're going to have a great lecture on glaucoma. I just want you to know that there are more options, okay? For surgery, there are lots of different surgeries, more now than ever before. Many new procedures for glaucoma surgery. They all work on a similar principle, and that is we need to make a new drain for this eye because the drain's not working, drops aren't working, laser hasn't worked. We need a new drain. So we literally create a guarded drain in this patient. What we do is we make a hole, like right here. The aqueous goes through that hole, but we cover that hole with sclera, and it has to go underneath that covering and out here under the conjunctiva. You will have a less complicated or sort of a better lecture on how we do that. I don't want to get into it too much just because there's a lot more to come. But I just want you to know that that's another option, surgical option. All right, so now as a review, we have covered the aqueous humor. Its function is to nourish the anterior segment, the focusing elements, all of the structures of the front of the eye. It is also responsible for eye pressure. When there are dysfunctions of that humor, we get, or aqueous humor dynamics, then we get a disease called glaucoma, in which there is peripheral vision loss and optic nerve damage that is often but not always associated with high eye pressure. And we treat that with drops, laser, and surgery. Are we all together? Yes, sir.
Can you have glaucoma without a high pressure?
The question is, can you have glaucoma and not have high eye pressure? You absolutely can have glaucoma with what we call normal pressure. And that's because there's a range in pressure over the population. And 21 might be normal for me, but 21, a pressure which is supposedly normal, might be your pressure, maybe is supposed to be 10. So if your pressure is 21, while it might be normal for me, not normal for you. Does that make sense?
So it's still the relative high pressure that's causing the optic
nerve. We think so. We believe so. Because we treat it in the same way. The question is, it's still relatively high pressure that's the underlying problem here. And that's how we treat it. There's still a lot to be learned in terms of what really is going on in glaucoma. But even for the person who has sort of normal pressure, we often treat them with drops and laser treatment the same as we treat everyone else. Yes, sir.
The risk factors that were mentioned at the beginning for glaucoma, are any of them associated particularly with open angle versus closed angle?
Most of those are open angle glaucoma. The risk factors for closed angle, really a crowded eye, a small eye, an eye with a large cataract in it, those are angle closure risks. And people with scarring inside the eye when the iris gets scarred, those people also are at risk for closed angle glaucoma. Yes? The question is, does the failure to tear properly cause glaucoma? It does not, because the tear layer is only on the outside of the eye, and the aqueous is on the inside of the eye, and they're very different in terms of what they bring to the structures that they are trying to nourish. Yes?
Two questions. Does high blood pressure correspond to high eye pressure?
The first question is, does high eye pressure have a correlation to high blood pressure? Are those two linked? The answer is no. Multiple studies have been done and show no, that's not the case.
Okay. And the joke was that people smoke marijuana to lower their ocular pressures. Is there any truth to that? And is there any responsible use for medical marijuana for glaucoma?
So there is good data showing that marijuana decreases eye pressure, but it does so very, very temporarily. So I had a patient once who asked exactly that question. I have lots of patients who ask that question. And I say, well, it could work to decrease eye pressure, but you pretty much have to smoke it continuously. And, of course, his response was, well, that's pretty much what I do. So, all right, so let's move on. We're going to talk next. Oh, I want to review a couple of things about glaucoma because I think it's pretty important. It's very important to have early diagnosis. We want to do serial eye pressure checks, optic nerve exam, state-of-the-art testing. It's also very important to have high risk or high index of suspicion in high-risk groups. So if I have a patient who is African-American and over 60, I look very hard for glaucoma because I don't want to miss it. Now, here in the Bay Area, there is a huge Asian population, which is also at high risk for glaucoma, especially narrow-angle glaucoma. So we want to be sure that we have a high index of suspicion. We may need to follow these people earlier and sooner. I like to aim for pretty aggressive treatment, 50% lowering of eye pressure, and earlier laser and surgery if that's indicated. People always ask me how they can reduce their own risk, and I always say, well, the one thing you can do is get an eye exam, especially if you're over 60 and if you have risk factors. When you get that eye exam, make sure your pupils are dilated. Not everyone gets a dilated exam, so make sure your pupils are dilated and that someone looks at your optic nerve. And ask your practitioner what your eye pressure is. Keep track of it yourself. Why not? It's a number that you can know, and if you ever move to a different doctor, they might ask you, well, what was your highest eye pressure? What has it been? So it's a good piece of information for you to know. Just like you know your blood pressure, you can know your eye pressure. Also, ask your family members if they have glaucoma, because you know what? They might not have had it 5 years ago, but they might have it now. Every decade, your risk for glaucoma increases, so you want to keep asking that question. And if you're on eye drops, take your eye drops. We can't treat your glaucoma if you don't take the drops. Okay, some more questions. Yes, sir.
Would you trust an optometrist to do that very exam that you're talking about?
I think optometrists are just as well trained as ophthalmologists. There are great optometrists and there are great ophthalmologists. Conversely, there are poor optometrists and poor ophthalmologists. I think if you have an excellent practitioner, then you have high likelihood of getting excellent care. Is that an appropriate answer?
It's politically correct.
Yes. Oh, so the question is, what are the other ways the optic nerve can get damaged other than high eye pressure? There are many ways the optic nerve can get damaged besides eye pressure. You can have strokes, you can have blood vessels abnormalities, you can have atrophy, you can have injury, many things, really outside the scope of my lecture. So I'm going to take a pass on your question. Yes. So the question is, do people in sunnier climates develop have a higher incidence of glaucoma? Yes?
So would you take
take, I mean, if you wear sunglasses all the time, is that something?
We often tell our patients to wear sunglasses. The problem is it's probably not the exposure that you get late in life. It's probably the exposure you get early in life.
What about eye color? Is there any lighter colored eyes?
We believe there may be some difference in lighter colored eyes. However, I think that heredity is more of a factor than eye color. I'm opening a can of worms. I can feel it. Yes.
What's the cause of the scarring that you were talking about?
There can be. The question is, what causes the iris scarring that can block the pupil? It's usually caused by inflammation in the eye, like an anterior uveitis. It can scar the pupil down, or it can scar the iris peripherally. The question is, do you need an eye pressure exam and a dilated exam, or one or the other? You need both, because the eye pressure is going to check the eye pressure. The dilated exam is the opportunity to look at the optic nerve and see if it appears damaged. One more question. I'll take all the rest of them later, I promise.
Is there any correlation between increased eye pressure and migraine headaches?
The question is there a correlation between high eye pressure and migraine headaches? Okay, I could be wrong, but I think the answer is no. I'm going to ask you to ask that again when Sean Lynn gives his glaucoma lecture, because I could be wrong. Okay, but I believe the answer is no. I'm going to move to the last section of my talk, which is the retina. This is the back of the eye. So we're moving from the front of the eye to the back of the eye. Now the function is very different. Now we're no longer talking about focusing or nourishing the focusing elements. Now we're talking about signal transduction. We are talking about taking a physical world and turning it, transducing it into an electrical signal. That's a very different job, right? And so the diseases, so the dysfunctions that the retina gets are also likewise very different. I'm going to tell you about retinopathy, most commonly caused by diabetes, and macular degeneration, for which we would treat with laser, surgery, and injection of medications. This is the retina. I think the retina is equally beautiful. You can tell. I think it's just, where else in the body can you look at blood vessels and nerves directly? Nowhere else. The eye is amazing, right? Right in the middle of the eye is this thing called the macula. The macula is the part of the retina that we use to see with. So when I'm looking at you, I am looking at you with my macula, okay? So seeing depends upon all this focusing that we've already talked about right onto the macula. The rest of the retina sees too. It's responsible for your peripheral vision, but the macula is what is responsible for your central, best, clearest, sharpest vision. And it is unfortunately the macula that is involved in macular degeneration. So let's back up a little bit before we talk about this. I need you to understand a little bit about retinal anatomy, all right? The retina is really quite an amazing structure. There are 9 layers of nerves that all talk to each other to create this coded signal of the physical world. Let's look at this a little bit more closely, shall we? Here is that retina, okay? Light comes from here, okay? We're coming in this direction, right? The front of the eye is on the floor, all right? And light is coming in here. It has to pass through the entire retina before it gets to these cells back here called the photoreceptors. These are the rods and the cones. These are the first cells that will fire an electrical signal when they see light, okay? The colored ones are the cones. They transduce color, light into colors. And the rods, the long black ones, see, if you will, in black and white. All right, and all these other layers of cells are cells that take that signal from the rods and cones and go towards the optic nerve. They are also cells and fibers that talk to each other and help to coordinate that image, that signaling. So by the end of it, this complex visual world, physical world, turns into a complex electrical coded message that is sent to the brain. Does that make sense? Have I lost anyone? All right. Okay, so this is how it looks as a diagram. And this is how it looks on electron microgram. Isn't that awesome? I know you think it's awesome. I think it's awesome. You can see the rods. You can see the cones.
Scale. What's it?
Nanometers. Nanometers. I couldn't tell you the scale, but it is on the order of nanometers. Certainly nothing we can see without an electron microscope. Okay, so now, just like all the other tissues that I've told you about depend on something for nourishment, so do those retinal photoreceptors. They depend on this thing called the retinal pigment epithelium. The retinal pigment epithelium delivers nutrients to the photoreceptors so that they can work. And the retinal pigment epithelium also takes away sort of waste products or garbage away so that the whole system doesn't get gummed up. All right, so our normal retina, remember, looks like this, right? Here's our macula. When we have our retinal pigment epithelium working, we have a macula that looks like this. When the retinal pigment epithelium doesn't work properly, then we have all of these sort of garbage waste products that build up in that retinal pigment epithelium, and it doesn't work properly. And that looks like this. And we have drusen. We call this drusen. They build up right in the macula. Do you see drusen out here? Well, you could get drusen out there, but in general, they happen right here in the macula. Why? Because that's where the photoreceptors are working the hardest. That's where they are in the highest concentration. They're packed super tightly in there. And so that's where we find problems often first. When the retinal pigment epithelium gets damaged enough, we get basically loss of overlying retina. This is a picture of basically you're seeing absence of retinal tissue, absence of retinal pigment epithelium. Here is a diagram where we see this drusen building up here under the retinal pigment epithelium. In some patients, another thing happens after that. There's a small opening that forms below that drusen under the retinal pigment epithelium, and through that opening, blood vessels grow. These are abnormal, incompetent blood vessels that ought not to be in this area because they can really only cause trouble. They can't do anything good. And when they grow in there, they tend to leak and they tend to bleed. And as a result, our macula gets leaky, byproducts of leaking, which is this exudate, this oil or lipid, and blood. And this is what we call wet or exudative macular degeneration.
Where was the light coming in two slides back from the bottom?
The light is coming in here from above, this way. This is the photoreceptor layer here, so light is coming in up here, this way. Okay? So what is macular degeneration? I define it as a disease in which there is degeneration of that retinal pigment epithelium resulting in overlying atrophy of the photoreceptors. It may or may not be associated with ingrowth and bleeding, or ingrowth of new blood vessels and bleeding. There is preferential loss of neurons, those photoreceptors, in the macula. The symptoms that people have with this are distortion, central blur, or a blind spot right in the center. As a result, you can't recognize faces. You can see everything else, but I can't see your face, right? It's in the center. It's that macular vision. As a result, it's very difficult. You can't drive because you can't see what you're looking at. You can't do near tasks like reading, sewing, computer work, meal preparation. The peripheral vision is usually intact, so you can usually walk around and navigate, but you just can't do near tasks. So again, you can't see the face. The periphery is intact. So contrast this. Now you guys know that in glaucoma, you can't see the periphery, right? It's the opposite. Does that make sense? So the question is, can you have both? You can. It's not common, but you can. You can, and that is devastating. What are the signs? So when we look at patients, we see decreased vision. We dilate the pupils, and we may see drusen, retinal pigment epithelial atrophy, and we may see those abnormal blood vessels or signs of those abnormal blood vessels as blood, fluid, deposits, and scar. How do we test? We use Amsler grid testing, which I'll show you, and that's a self-test. That's why I want to show it to you. We use fluorescein angiogram and optical coherence tomogram, where we're looking at the layers of the retina. So the only one of the, again, okay, so now here's one of those, I don't want to steal anyone's thunder comments. Jackie Duncan, another great friend of mine in our department, is going to give you a wonderful talk on macular degeneration. She's going to go into all of this in great detail. But I do want to, so I'm not going to tell you about fluorescein angiography or optical coherence tomograms, but I am going to tell you about Amsler grids. Why? Because you can do this yourself. You can download a copy of an Amsler grid from the internet, and you can, the way you use this, this is a test of your macular vision, your central vision. Cover one eye, look at that central black dot with one eye, and so everyone do it just to see what you get. And all of those squares should look square. All the lines should be straight. There shouldn't be any distortion or waviness. Or if there is distortion or waviness, then this is your baseline. Okay? If the squares look something like this, that's not good. Maybe I shouldn't have showed the Amsler grid. I don't know. So we usually have people do this once a week, one eye at a time. I tell people, put an Amsler grid on your refrigerator and do it once a week so that you can self-monitor. And if you see changes in your Amsler grid, you should go see your ophthalmologist. So our goals for macular degeneration treatment are to optimize vision, to slow down or reverse the vision loss, and to alert family members that they may need an exam. We have some data now that shows that there are supplements that help to slow down the risk of macular, the vision loss and macular degeneration. Vitamin A, C, E, zinc, and copper have been shown to be helpful. There are commercially available macular degeneration vitamins. I believe the one that is generally best liked is something called PreserVision. However, Dr. Duncan will tell you what she thinks of all these supplements and which ones are the best. We also like to in the spirit of optimizing vision, we like to have people go see low vision therapists, occupational therapists, to find different ways to do the same tasks. We work with magnification, screen projection. Now that we all have iPads or some similar device, people are reading again because they can magnify the text big enough that it occupies more than that central vision. Dr. Duncan may also tell you about implantable telescopes, which has also really improved our ability to improve vision. Yes.
Do you need to take all those vitamins or just some?
So the vitamins that have been shown to work are in a cocktail. All the research was done with a cocktail of these vitamins, and now, guess what? They are commercially available in exactly the cocktail that was shown to be efficacious for a fairly significant cost. Yes. The question is, what period of time does the macular degeneration, how long is it there before it's bad? The drusen can be there for a long time without much visual compromise. The problem comes when you start to lose photoreceptors. So it really depends on how quickly the retinal pigment epithelium deteriorates to the point where the photoreceptors are getting lost. And that, quite frankly, is different for everybody, and mostly dependent on your genetics. Yes. The question is, do the eye vitamins slow down the progression or prevent? They generally slow down the progression. We don't usually give the vitamins to people who don't have macular degeneration. Question.
What about prevention? What do you think about vitamin D, adequate vitamin D?
So the question is there a role for vitamin D in prevention? I'll be very honest with you. I don't know the answer to that. Save that question for Jackie Duncan. I don't know. I don't think so. That's my way of saying I don't think so, but I could be wrong. I'm going to keep going. Save your questions. I'll answer all of them to the best of my ability. There is something new on the scene for macular degeneration, specifically for wet macular degeneration. Remember those blood vessels that I showed you that were growing? Well, they grow because they are being sort of encouraged to grow by the stuff called vascular endothelial growth factor. Well, we now have these drugs that inhibit vascular endothelial growth factor, and we inject them directly into the eye. I'm not going to show you a picture. I'm not going to show you any more videos of the injection. The only problem is we have to do it frequently. Usually these people get injected monthly for about 6 months, and then we try to go for longer. We do put that drug right inside the eye. It's not for the faint of heart, but it is amazing how well this is tolerated. We do it all day long in the clinic, and people do very well. And this is how it works. So here's the situation. All these abnormal blood vessels are growing where they ought not to be growing. They're leaking and they're bleeding. We inject this drug into the middle of the eye, and that inhibits that vascular endothelial growth factor. These blood vessels now have nothing that's stimulating their growth. They then sort of stop growing, and it returns pretty much to normal. As a result, all this leakage and bleeding that used to be there dries up. And for the first time, when I was in residency, we didn't have any of this. And so once people had bad wet macular degeneration, there was nothing to do. Now we actually can inject these drugs into the eye, and for the first time we can restore vision. People's vision improves after these injections. The downside, of course, is that the injections have to continue. You can't stop. Once you stop, the vision goes back. Question. The question is, does the solution go into the rest of the body somehow? It seems to stay in the eye. It's very hard to get things to come out of the eye. So if, let's say you have bleeding inside the eye, that it's hard to get that blood out. Things tend to stay in the eye. All right, so now I'm going to make a little bit of a transition. We talked about injecting these drugs for all these blood vessels that are growing for macular degeneration. Now let's change gears a little bit and talk about another disease in which blood vessels grow, another disease in which we use these same drugs to retard that growth of blood vessels. This is diabetic retinopathy. I want to cover this topic because diabetes is a huge problem in our society, and diabetic retinopathy is a major cause of vision loss. In diabetes, however, I think this answers your question, sir. Those blood vessels don't grow under the retina. They grow on the surface of the retina. And as a result, these incompetent blood vessels grow, they leak, they bleed, and they cause problems within the retina. Here's a picture of sort of moderate or diabetic retinopathy. You have abnormal blood vessels. We have this leakage over here, over here. If I had to define diabetic retinopathy, what diabetes does to the eye is it damages the blood vessels of the eye, the tiny little capillaries at the very ends, the smallest blood vessels. And as a result, the tissues that depend on those blood vessels become starved for all those blood products. And that oxygen deprivation we call ischemia. Okay, oxygen deprivation is ischemia. That drives the signal that, hey, I need new blood vessels. And then new blood vessels grow by this mediated through this vascular endothelial growth factor. So once again, we have elaboration of this vascular endothelial growth factor. New blood vessels grow, this time in the retina, on top of the retina rather than underneath it. They still bleed and leak. So our treatment this time is still on decreasing the ischemia, decreasing that signaling to make more blood vessels. So the way we do that is, well, first we want to, this is what the eye looks like before those new blood vessels grow. And here we have new blood vessels growing right around this disc. And I'll show you what that looks like. In a real eye, all these blood vessels are abnormal, right? They're not supposed to be there. They're here, they're out here in the periphery. So this eye has significant, what we call proliferative, because new blood vessels are proliferating, diabetic retinopathy. As a result, these blood vessels are, they're not competent. They're not going to solve the oxygen deprivation or the ischemia. They're only going to bleed and leak, causing all these hemorrhages in the eye. So our treatment then is to decrease that ischemic signaling. So what do? We laser the peripheral retina. We laser that retina. That is the tissue that's sort of starving, if you will, and ischemic. We laser it so that it's no longer starving, and that allows the rest of this retina to sort of be saved, if you will. We also will inject this anti-VEGF drugs into the eye to retard the growth of these blood vessels. Have I lost anyone? Is everyone with me?
I just don't follow what the laser did.
Okay. So the question is, I don't follow what the laser did. So I was trying to sort of not be too graphic. Yeah, we basically do destroy about half of the retina because that retina is already, it's kind of doing more damage a little bit than good. We always feel sad to destroy any part of the eye, but we are basically destroying half of that retina to decrease the ischemic signal. Questions?
Does yes. the retina regenerate?
The question is, does the retina regenerate? The answer is no. Question. So the question is, what causes that ischemia? Diabetes, what it does is it damages the tiniest blood vessels and causes them to just close off and not work. So as a result, those blood vessels are lost. The tissues that depended on those blood vessels for oxygen become ischemic. That makes sense? Yes. So the question is, can hypertension do the same thing? There is an entity called hypertensive retinopathy, and it usually it causes occlusion. It can cause a retinopathy similar to diabetic retinopathy. We usually don't see it like this. Why? Because it doesn't tend to cause, it's causing blood pressure in the large vessels. That blood pressure, by the time it gets to the small, tiny vessels, is less. So it's not quite as devastating as diabetic retinopathy. Yes? The question is, can the ophthalmologist or optometrist readily detect diabetic eye disease and macular degeneration? Absolutely. So let's review now what we've talked about. The retina is the image transducer, right? Its job is to encode the visual light, the light into an electrical impulse that's sent to the brain. When it doesn't work well, it usually results in some type of retinopathy. Diabetic retinopathy is the most common, or macular degeneration, which we treat with laser, surgery, and injections. So I think the question is, can you get a retinal artery or vein occlusion from trauma? The answer is not usually. Usually trauma is more likely to cause a retinal detachment or a macular hole, but if you have enough of an injury that you cause an embolus from somewhere else in the body, you can get a retinal vascular occlusion. Or if you have transection or injury to the optic nerve, that may cause blockage of blood flow, thereby giving you some type of artery or vein occlusion. So the next question is, what does stroke do to the eye? The stroke, in a brain stroke, causes abnormal visual field. Basically, what's happening there is part of the brain that subserves vision is being damaged. So depending on what part of the brain was damaged, that will tell you what part of the visual field is no longer visible. It's black. Yes?
Can trauma accelerate cataract?
The question is, can trauma accelerate cataract? The answer is yes, absolutely. Trauma can accelerate cataract or produce its own type of cataract. I love this quote. In fact, looking back, it seems to me that I was clueless until about age 50. Well, this year I turned 50, and I'll tell you something. I feel like the magnitude of what I don't know keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So I want to leave you with a couple of important facts about the eye. Over the age of 40, 75% of all legal blindness and 85% of vision impairment is caused by these three problems: macular degeneration, glaucoma, and diabetic retinopathy. The dollar cost for this is $35.4 billion. It's an impact, a budgetary impact of $13.7 billion. And that was in 2006. Might be worse now as the population ages. Cataract is the number, as I told you, is the number one cause of vision loss. It is the number one thing we do that is reimbursed by Medicare. That doesn't mean it's the thing that gets paid best. It just means that we do so much of it that a substantial portion of the Medicare dollar goes to reimbursing cataract surgery. Macular degeneration is the number one cause of vision loss in this country. Glaucoma is the number one cause of vision loss in African Americans. Here's my ocular to-do list for you. Eat a healthy diet. It's always a good thing, right? Stop unhealthy habits like smoking. See an ophthalmologist. That's a shameless plug. Make sure you get appropriate glasses and treat the things that can be treated. Treat your systemic diseases. The better treatment you have for diabetes and hypertension, the better off your eyes will do. And find out about your family history. If you need help, my partners and I are happy to help. You have been a delightful audience. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.